WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I'm in the studio with Ralph Flood, and we're going to, in just a few minutes, hear a talk that was recently given at LaSalle College by I.F. Stone. But Ralph, can you tell us a bit about I.F. Stone before we hear that talk?
Well, sure, Terry. He's originally a native of this area, went to the University of Pennsylvania, and only recently got a degree from it, I think, late in life. And he's very fondly remembered by many people as the editor of I.F. Stone's Weekly, an independent four-page commentary and investigation of events largely in Washington having to do with Congress, the Pentagon, and things like that, that was full of some of the most incisive and illuminating investigation around during the 50s and 60s. I guess it started back in the 40s, went on for a long time. He gave it up a few years ago. It just became too much for him, a one-man job every week, and then toward the end, biweekly, every 2 weeks, that is, and began writing for the New York Review of Books. Like our previous guest, John Dean, I.F. Stone has a lot of enemies. They're of different persuasion, for the most part, from Dean's, but he's still around writing for the New York Review. A film, a documentary film, has been made of him recently called I.F. Stone's Weekly. Very good documentary. And he was here at LaSalle talking about the intelligence network in America, whether it's compatible with a democracy at all, with our historical traditions. And he came to the conclusion, which we'll be hearing, that largely it's a futile thing anyway. It's not the way to achieve national security. That's I.F. Stone's view, and here is I.F. Stone.
I don't want to rehash a lot of horrors, but I'd like with you to explore some fresh and basic perspectives on this whole intelligence miasma that now afflicts our country. You know, one division between a free society and an unfree society is that a free society trusts its people, and an unfree society asks the people to trust the government. You know, when Jimmy Carter said in the election campaign, "Trust me," he was really talking a language that the founding fathers would have found it hard to understand, because one of the most basic premises of the American government is that you don't trust the government. You don't trust any official. However good, well-intentioned, well-meaning, the essence of the American system, as you know, is a system of checks and balances that reflects the view that power is corrupting and dangerous, and that men may do dreadful things, not only for evil purposes, but for purposes they consider good, and which may indeed be beneficent in their ultimate purposes. And of course, the excuse for a widespread spy network, and we have one, and one of the evils is that students are enlisted and subsidized and already corrupted by the FBI and the CIA on the campuses. One of the big excuses is, well, we have to protect the national security. That's the price we have to pay for maintaining the stability of the realm and a law and order. And this has always been the excuse in every spy-haunted society. And it's interesting to look back and ask ourselves, how would the founding fathers have felt about the current intelligence miasma and this widespread view that Nixon helped to launch that national security was somehow an excuse for bending, flexing, or breaking the law, and when it seemed that the higher purpose of protecting the national security and the national interest was at stake. And of course, as you all know, and as I'd like to explore with you, the founding fathers and the Constitution operated on a diametrically opposite basis. There are constitutions in the world with emergency clauses for national security matters. If you look at ours, except for our reference to the habeas corpus provision in time of war, none of the basic guarantees carry an exception. The First Amendment doesn't say there's freedom of speech except where national security is involved. The Fourth Amendment doesn't say a man's home is his castle except where national security is involved. But one of the basic ways to judge their attitude toward the excuse of national security is to see their attitude toward the crime of treason. And it's very illuminating and very much worth remembering and very much worth telling our fellow citizens that when the Founding Fathers came to deal with treason, the most overt danger to national security, everything they did, everything they wrote, was intended not to protect the state, but to protect the individual. The framers were 18th century gentlemen. This problem of treason was an old problem. They were aware of the history of the Roman Republic and the Roman Empire, where lese majeste and treason played quite a role. They had read Montesquieu's Spirit of the Laws, where Montesquieu says that you can judge whether a government is lawful or despotic by whether the definition of treason is exact and concrete or vague. Because where it's vague, like the phrase national security itself, it has led historically to terrible abuses. And the Constitution defines treason as aid and comfort to the enemy or making war upon the United States. It's couched in terms of war and not in terms of peace. The idea of peacetime treason is not envisaged by the Constitution. The treason clause calls for conviction only in open court. They were too well aware, as we are in our own time from experience in other countries, how easily confessions can be beaten out of people by secret police. Had to be a confession in open court. And there had to be an overt act so that the body of the Constitution itself, and of course the Bill of Rights, which was added on popular demand and protest before as the price of ratification of the Constitution, provided no exceptions, no loopholes for so-called national security. One of the basic causes of an intelligence, a spy miasma, is a fear of change. And in a property society like ours, a capitalist society, it's fear of change and damage to the rights of property. The CIA, our main foreign intelligence operative, and the FBI, our main domestic intelligence operative, have quite a long family tree. The real origin the abuses that we have seen exposed in recent years in connection with the FBI begin with local red squads, local bomb squads, as they were sometimes called. The fear of radicalism, which is first of all a fear of Democrats, which was then a bad name, as you know, appeared in the Alien and Sedition period under John Adams. And then there was a good deal of hysteria against the abolitionists, who were seen as a menace to private property, although they focused only on slaves. And then in the 80s, there was a great hysteria about the anarchists. And very early, in fact, long before Karl Marx, a fear of communists. In fact, and of communism, because the word is older than Marx. For example, in the Constitutional Convention of New York State in the 1820s, when it was proposed that the state establish free public education and give everybody, even people without property, the right to vote, because up until then, only persons with a certain amount of property had the right to vote. One of our great jurists, Chancellor Chase, opposed the reform on the ground that if you educated people and gave them the vote, they would vote away the rights of property. And in the 1890s, when we got our first income tax, a very mild 2% ungraduated tax, which was held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court at the time, the great argument against it was that it was a beginning of communism. The fact is that one of the best ways to have a stable and secure society is to have a healthy representation of radicals and revolutionists around, because they are, in a sense, the sensitive epidermis of the society, more acutely aware of its injustices and its maladjustments than the ordinary contented, insensitive, and unimaginative citizen. And to have them around and to let them talk and agitate is one of the best ways to awaken people to the existence of evils, and one of the best ways to achieve that kind of understanding and consensus that makes possible a peaceful reform and orderly adjustment. You know, one of the things wrong, a certain amount of intelligence is inescapable. It's like any other vice in a society. You're not going to get completely rid of it, but the job is not to over-encourage it and to keep it within reasonable bounds. In our case, however, there are more than 70 different agencies in Washington that have some intelligence function, and there are about 12 agencies that are largely devoted to the collection of intelligence information represented on the U.S. Intelligence Board, over which the CIA presides. And the result is that to an increasing extent, and a very dangerous extent, the discussion of policy and the making of policy occurs on two different levels. And in this respect, we're in danger of duplicating the very evils that we deplore in the Soviet Union. There, for the general public, the press is allowed to print comparatively little, and most of it in terms of baby talk, the same kind of baby talk we see in communist China today in that press. With all due respect to Mao and reform and all the rest of it, it's still baby talk. And it's only at various stages of the party pyramid that people are let in to various stages of the supposed full truth. One of the reasons why the Vietnam War went on for so long is because of this double system of debate. You may remember when John F. Kennedy I was so amazed at the difference between the secret reports he was getting and what he read in the newspapers. He called in General Krulak of the Marines and David Halberstam of the New York Times and said, in effect, you two guys seem to be writing about two different wars. Which one is the real one? And of course, the real one was the one that Halberstam was writing about and most of the newspapermen were writing about, and the unreal one was the one that General Krulak was reporting about. Nevertheless, it's very interesting that even with so young and likable a president as John F. Kennedy, the upshot of the meeting was that he tried to get the New York Times to take Halberstam out of Vietnam, and General Krulak got an extra star and was made a lieutenant general. One of the things wrong is that a government that depends on an intelligence network tends to delude itself. You know, people have the idea that the way to know what's going on is to have thousands of listening devices and secret agents and buy secrets and seduce foreign rulers and get the inside stuff. The significant truth about any period of history is not learned by peeping through peepholes. It isn't a matter of secrets. It's a matter of intelligence of quite a different kind, in which diverse and dynamic and changing phenomena have to be examined and re-examined in the light of many different ideas, frames of reference, philosophies, that some conception of reality hammered out in debate before one begins to comprehend it. Even now, most of the great periods of history are still the subject of violent controversy among the historians. There's one simple truth about an intelligence network, and that is nobody likes to hear and finds it easy to absorb, nobody, me or you or the government, likes to hear what goes against our preconceptions. And you don't get promoted if you rush into the boss and tell him he's wrong and show him why. And you don't get elected a cardinal by criticizing the Pope or telling him that an encyclical was wrong. To get ahead in intelligence, you tell the boss what he wants to hear. One of the reasons why the Vietnam War was so well covered by the press is the closer you got to the field and talked to men in the field, military officers, aid officers, intelligence officers of various kinds, the more reporters got a glimpse not only of the reality, but the terrible frustration of the men in the field and their incapacity to get the truth to Washington. It was filtered out at various levels. You may remember the admiral who called in a reporter and said, hey, what team are you on? What team are you on? The idea is not to find the truth and tell it, but report what helps your team. And by the time it got up to the White House, and this is true in every society, the intelligence networks tend to become a way to reinforce the misconceptions, errors, cockeyed views of the ruling class in every society. You know, the last head of the secret police in Russia, the Okhrana, the Tsarist secret police, tells in his memoirs how he assured the Tsarina about a year before their overthrow there would never be a revolution in Russia. And the same evils exist in the Soviet Union today. If you study carefully the Pike Report and the reports of the Church Committee and our own investigations of the intelligence miasma, you will see that from time to time, the intelligence agencies did turn in good reports. But when they had a realistic view, it tended to be ignored. And when they had an unrealistic view that said, we're winning the war, everything's fine, this is the way to do it. That's what the officials heard. And you know, if you're an official in Washington and you're very busy and you don't have time to read the papers and you get a report and it's stamped secret or top secret or eyes only or need to know, there's about, there's a couple dozen different kinds of stamps on this malarkey. It has a certain divine afflatus. It's the real poop. It's the inside dope. It's something that the ordinary people, you and I, don't get. It must be true. Now, this material, and I've seen some things very much akin to it in the RAND Corporation reports, which is a kind of a civilian, semi-classified offshoot of the intelligence apparatus. It's about on a level with a good magazine article, just about that much, a mixture of truth, partial truth, argument, opinion, and there's no harm in it. There's no harm in a magazine article. It's published. Somebody can answer it, debate it, discuss it, say, well, what are the preconceptions of the writer, evaluate it. That's the way you do it intended to do it in the debates of a free society. But when the guys on the inside get these secret reports and they're not debated and they're not analyzed, there's no real discussion, and they're given the aura of the real stuff, it really is an impediment to sound decision. Furthermore, paranoia is the occupational disease of all secret police agencies. And paranoia is a very poor guide to the fashioning of public policy. The whole idea of free debate, free discussion, open decisions, openly arrived at, is to get a healthy and realistic view, not a view of the world as a place that is under a satanic influence. You know, the belief in Satanism and demons goes on under many different guises. In the Soviet Union, the demons are known as Trotskyites or revisionists. Every ruling class prefers demonological and paranoid explanations, because any realistic explanation of why there's discontent would lead it to confront the necessity of giving up some of its privileges. Our representative during the French Revolution in London, Governor Morris, in his memoirs, tells about his contacts with the French emigres, and their attitude was very much like that of the Russian Tsarist emigres. They couldn't believe that all these respectful peasants who tipped their hats in the field in the morning to the great Lord could possibly have made a revolution. It must have been some kind of satanic demon, some kind of insidious subversive that crept into their souls and overturned it. And through the ages, there have been various names for them at various times: Freemasons, Jesuits, Democrats, Trotskyists, communists, dogmatists, revisionists, and always the view that everything's all right. You don't have to give up your privileges. You don't have to give more to the poor. They're perfectly content. They're very happy. They're always laughing and making jokes. They're so happy. All you need to do is watch for this handful of agitators, demons, of supernatural power, who by their little voices here and there can overturn great empires unless scotched, burned at the stake, killed, put in the prison, brainwashed, or something done with them to stop stop change before it happens. And we're drifting in that direction. On the one hand, I must say, and those of you that study philosophy know that contradictory statements may equally be true. On the one hand, it's very encouraging and something to be proud of. I don't know of any other society but ours that has ever kicked the police agencies around and exposed them the way we've been doing the last few years. The only similar therapeutic measure I know of was a very barbarous one, and that is Stalin. Stalin's one really vital contribution to political science was, in my opinion, that every couple of years he'd call in the head of the secret police and bump him off. One of the things wrong with the FBI was we kept J. Edgar Hoover in there until he became a tin god. Actually, the longest serving a public official in Washington. He went back to the Wilson era. And it's very interesting, by the way, very few people know it. The FBI was established against the wishes of Congress. In 1907, a bill to establish a Federal Bureau of Investigation was voted down after an extremely interesting debate in which members of Congress warned that it would move a free republic in the direction of a police state. Nevertheless, despite the vote of Congress, Teddy Roosevelt, Attorney General Bonaparte, a nephew or grandnephew of the great Napoleon Bonaparte, who was his Attorney General, established the FBI in 1908, the following year, by executive order. Despite the fact that we've had all these exposés and that the Freedom of Information Act has allowed a very tiny party, the Socialist Workers' Party, to do our democratic system great service by exposing the way in which lawful political activities were harassed and shadowed. And that we've had this period of public education, nothing really fundamental has happened. As long as they exist, they're very hard to control. You know, I've been in Washington since 1940, and one of the most elementary observations about the government is how difficult it is to control any agency of government, even if you're the head of it. It's like a newspaper. It's hard to control a newspaper if you're the head of it, too. Or any organization is difficult to control. But a secret organization, especially with operatives all over the world, some of them 10,000 miles away, and an organization that naturally attracts screwballs, adventurers, corkscrews. You know, the head of the mental institutions in the province of Saskatchewan in Canada did a study in the 1950s that I wrote about in the Weekly for the English journal 20th Century and After. And he made a study of the heads of the great police services of Europe after at the time of the First World War. And it was interesting.